Well, g'day, and welcome to another edition of the National Conservative Institute of Australia podcast. My guest today is Philip Blond, author most famously of Red Tory, How Left and Right Have Broken Britain and How We Can Fix It, which was published about 15 years ago. Today we discuss why it has been so difficult to change the British Conservative Party since the release of his book, whether elective representatives of the British Conservative Party really understand conservatism, his views on Blue Labour, national conservatism, and whether Donald Trump is a red Tory, and much more. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, Philip Blond, welcome to the NatCon Australia podcast.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Great. Now, you are famous for having originally written a book called Red Tory, How the Left and the Right Have Broken Britain and How We Can Fix It. As we were just discussing before we got online, that concept is probably still not as well understood in the UK as it should be, and I guarantee it's not well understood in Australia. So from the top, what do you mean by Red Tory, Red Toryism?
Okay.
How does it differ from the political ideology of Reagan and Thatcher?
Okay, so what I've been trying to do in my work is take the concept of liberalism and separate and differentiate it from conservatism, and then talk about what would be, if you forgive the phrase, an emancipatory conservatism. What would a conservatism be that wasn't merely a defense of privilege or of the status quo? And what Red Toryism is a coherent attempt to repudiate liberalism in both its left and right-wing form. So I think the innovation of Red Toryism and why it's resonated insofar as it has amongst kind of the intellectual class, for want of a better word, is it's the first bit of genuine post-liberalism that I sort of started writing about it sort of 2008, 2009. And for me, the left has pursued social liberalism that has led to the fragmentation of society, identity politics, the inability to articulate the common good. And the right has pursued economic liberalism that has essentially further annihilated and eroded the economic and social security of working class people and increasingly middle class people as well. And hitherto, I think it's fair to say, with the possible exception of Christopher Lash, nobody had made the case that left liberalism and right liberalism were two sides of the same coin, and that both were to be resisted. If we wanted to produce a country that served all of its citizens, that secured everybody, not just those in the top 5 or 10%. And so Red Toryism, which builds on a communitarian conservative Canadian tradition of the same name, but didn't have quite the same critiques I have, is an attempt to coherently repudiate liberalism, anathematize it, separate it from conservatism, and produce a post-liberal conservatism. And then the interesting question is, does it have to be conservative? And we can go into that. But broadly speaking, I think yes, because conservation is one of its primary roles, conserving the family and the hopes and dreams of ordinary people.
At the recent ARC conference in London, the leader of the British Conservative Party, Kemi Badenoch, gave a speech, and she talked about liberalism and classical liberalism as though that were the governing ideology of the British Conservative Party, which would have been used to Benjamin Disraeli, right? So do you think the majority of the British Conservatives understand conservatism that as opposed to liberalism?
No, they do not. And Kemi Badenoch is a libertarian and a liberal. She's not all liberal. There are certain elements of social conservatism in her kind of belief package, if you will. But predominantly, she's a market liberal. And as a result, she's out of step with the needs of the country and where the people are. The great tragedy of the British Conservative Party is it only selects and elects market liberals and social liberals. And the selection process for MPs has been tightly controlled since the time of Cameron. And as a result, they have a parliamentary party whose value system is significantly distant from its voting base. Its voting base is much closer to reform, is much more clearly and demonstrably post-liberal. It's opposed to neoliberal economics and it's opposed to neoliberal social policies from transgenderism onwards. So the problem the Conservative Party has is the vast majority of the powerful figures within it are no longer redolent or resonant with the voting base of the Conservative Party. And that's why Nigel Farage in Britain is making the headway he is. The tragedy is that Farage is also an economic liberal, a social conservative is an economic liberal. So a synthesis of that old Reagan-Bush mix that's now been thoroughly broken in America, but still persists in Britain and, of course, in Australia and elsewhere. And until we select MPs who have beliefs that are more in line with their voting base, this is going to repeat. So we still have a liberal oligopoly of left and right who still deliver us social and economic liberalism, even though it doesn't deliver, even though it makes no difference, even though it's failed and is failing economically and socially. So that is the problem.
You had a decent hearing from David Cameron, right? Were you an advisor to him, or you certainly had his ear for a period of time, and he used or invoked your name, or at least some of the concept of your book, when he was promoting something called The Big Society over there, right? How did you get on with David Cameron? Were some of your ideas realized in policy outcomes during his time?
Yeah, I mean, David's great merit is he was thoughtful and he understood the social cost of the liberalism of which he was a part. And he really did enthuse about the big society, which I and others worked on, which still remains a good idea, but it can't exist when it's squeezed by liberalisms of left and right. But ultimately, he was a Thatcherite and he was enthralled to George Osborne. He was a very clever man, but one-dimensional and only had austerity and the Thatcherite approach. And you have to look back on Conservative governments from the election of Cameron and say they failed. They failed to revive Britain's productivity problem, which is the perennial problem, which precedes the great crash of 2008. And they failed to solve any of the endemic social and economic problems of the country. And so that whole ideology set has failed all along the line. And I've worked with every prime minister on the Conservative side, up to and including Johnson. And Johnson got it more than anybody else. And I would talk with him to quite a detailed level. But he was also a social liberal and massively increased migration to unprecedented levels. So none of them are fit for purpose. All of them ultimately, historically, have failed and are poor quality in terms of what they did and didn't do for the country. And this is the tragedy. We do have a small minority of very good MPs like Danny Kruger and Nick Timothy, but they're in the minority and they're not going to govern in the conceivable future. The only hope the British Conservative Party has is if it elects Robert Jenrick, because Badenoch is clearly failing and shows no signs of cut through or succeeding. And she can't, because ultimately she's, for reasons that one wants to be charitable about, but it's hard, hasn't come up with any policies and just reasserts principles, but principles automatically lead to policies. So I find her leadership vacuous and ungoverned. And as a result, things are failing. People are getting more and more anxious about the state of the country, and they will go to reform. That's clear and obvious.
Nicholas Timothy, and you mentioned Danny Kruger, and Miriam Cates, who I know a little bit better, were MPs. Nicholas Timothy was actually an advisor to Theresa May. And you say Boris Johnson understood the red Tory thing. Why is it then that it's, if they understood it, why is it not possible to translate it into effectively?
Well, look, post-liberalism, when I first wrote Red Tory, the idea was laughed at by all the so-called cognoscente in the newspapers. And this is always a good sign, of course. And now post-liberalism governs politics on the right across the West. Hmm. So I sort of, the very alignment I spoke about the the right allying itself with the working class, is exactly what happened. And it's happened manifestly across Europe, in anything in France, from Rassemblement National to AfD in Germany to Italy, across the piece, and of course, most evidently with Trump in America. Now, I'm not saying I agree with all the forms of populism and racial identification operative there, but that is clearly what has happened. Mm. And we have had poor quality leaders in the Conservative Party since Cameron who aren't intellectually capable of grasping the reality of the situation they're in. Cameron's misfortune is he's the most intellectually able, but he was formed and shaped in a Thatcherite era and ultimately was a creature of that and couldn't escape it. So unless we have high quality intellectual, they don't have to be intellectual. Mrs. Thatcher wasn't an intellectual, but she grasped the intellectual consequences. Mm. Unless we have a leadership that intellectually grasps the current agenda and what we face, we will continue to have mediocre leaders who won't perform. And so the most important issue is to have high quality MPs and high quality politicians. And at the moment, the Conservative Party has always had a covert kind of second committee sitting on every selection. And they have relentlessly ensured it's either social or economic liberals who get selected. Mm. And so you have a party that's dominated by one mindset, that is able to repeat that mindset, that is gradually and somewhat inexorably, moving away from its electoral base. And that explains, you know, the vast majority of the rationale behind the support for reform.
Mm. At least I would say, at least in the UK, your party is called the Conservative Party. The party in Australia for the centre-right is called the Liberal Party. And I don't think that's fully understood in the UK, because it's actually unique in the Anglosphere. You came out to Australia at least once, and you had your informal advisor, or you certainly had the ear of Tony Abbott, the then Prime Minister at the time. Do you think he understood and agreed with red Toryism?
Well, I always liked Tony. I still do. And he also had a Catholic background in sort of Catholic communitarian thinking. I just think ultimately he's persuaded by neoliberalism. He's a social conservative who's persuaded by neoliberalism. And that is a very successful synthesis that governed the world for 30 years. Now, Australia is in the interesting position of being in the Asian growth zone, if we can put it like that, where you have the resources of a continent divided amongst a very small population. Mm. And so you're, in some sense, protected from the economic consequences that hit Europe and hit America, which is globalization leading to deindustrialization and the making insecure of the entire kind of working European Western working class. But by the same token, these forces will ultimately also take root in Australia and create oligopolies that produce the same type of rentier economy that we're getting elsewhere, where there's massive capture of assets. Think of housing in Sydney or Melbourne, and the opening up of the difference between rates of growth and rates of wage growth. This will also happen to you. Plus, if migration goes at a large scale, you'll start to get the cultural disaggregation that we've also suffered. But Australia tends to take its migrants from countries that absorb more easily. But there's always a tipping point with different cultures where once it passes a certain number, the need to integrate falls away and people start separating again, which is what's happened in Britain.
Yeah, I always feel like there's a particular knack that or a pose that British intellectuals or others adopt when they write books or letters, you know, a warning from Britain to America or Australia about where you're heading and this sort of thing from, you know, from where we've seen it. And I always come back for people I know in the UK and say, look, we are very, very, very much catching up faster than you think on immigration and economics and a whole lot of other things. It's not the future of which you speak is not, you know, that far off. How do you... This red Toryism, let me give you a quote. Liberal opinions are the opinions of those who would be free from certain constraints and regulations, from a certain dependence and duty deemed necessary for the general or popular welfare. Liberal opinions are very convenient opinions for the rich and the powerful. That's Benjamin Disraeli. So how are you, is red Toryism different from that traditional conservatism?
No, I think red Toryism has deep echoes in a conservatism that differentiates itself from liberalism. So Disraeli would be one obvious place to go. Mm-hmm. And also it's akin with his kind of young England romanticism. So I view Disraeli as very much a red Tory. But the conservative critique of liberalism goes back to Bolingbroke. It's there. Mm. It's there in Burke's kind of post-Whig phase. It's throughout the tradition. And what's really interesting and what we haven't developed successfully is what an economics, a post-liberal economics, would look like. Mm. Now, in part, Trump, however, whatever you may think of what he's trying to do, is trying to do that with tariffs. He's trying to reindustrialize America through tariffs. They probably miscalculated or probably didn't even account for the bond market and the fact that debt would start to be priced much higher, which I think has torpedoed the political economy somewhat. But it does behove us to try to start looking for a political economy that doesn't rely on the governing our world through plutocracy and creating market concentrations that turn the majority into a serf vassal kind of relationship, which is what's happening. And yeah, the key for that is distributing assets. And people owning assets, that's the only thing that can kind of escape this, really.
Yeah. I mean, trade policy is where the rubber hits the road, in my view, because it is just assumed amongst the right in Australia that obviously you cannot be on the right unless you're in favour of free trade. And then when I point out to people, well, hang on, the founder of the Liberal Party, Robert Menzies, was against free trade, was in favour of tariffs, even on Britain. But not only that, throughout the New World, Canada, all the founders of presidents on Mount Rushmore, you know, in retrospect, and Disraeli, even though he was at the high point of, you know, Gladstonian liberalism in the late 19th century, was also skeptical of free trade. But when you make that point, people don't know what you're talking about. They just assume that it must have been some odd, I don't know, odd idiosyncratic view that the Conservative Party and these parties held in the past, and that obviously and is completely nonsensical.
Well, the point is to say is we don't have free trade now, even before Trump.
Yeah.
Every country in the world has a system of tariffs already in place, whether it be phytosanitary on food, on animal welfare, on carbon, on, and they introduce these tariffs in order that we have fair competition between our domestic industry and what we're importing. So if we're importing an industry that's subsidized, for the sake of argument, by energy or some other factor by 10%, we put tariffs on to ensure free trade. So the point about free trade is it's never free, and you need state power to make markets free, because markets are not naturally free. Markets naturally tend to monopoly. They don't naturally tend to open competition. And all of those with vested power in markets aim for monopoly of one form or another, because then they can charge more for their services and their delivery isn't threatened. So the free market is a result of state coercion or state practice, if you see what I mean. So every market is shaped by the regulations that enframe it, and we regulate to achieve the outcomes we want. Now, if you're a developing market, you might want to have tariffs to prevent your nascent manufacturing or chemical industry from being completely eradicated by imports, where a predatory foreign firm might dump their products, might seek to eliminate you so they can dominate the market afterwards. So we've never had a purely free trade situation ever in the history of humanity. And we already circumscribe our market exchange by what we want to achieve. Now, the interesting thing is, once you globalize debt and once you let transnational actors buy your debt and you build up debt, you're no longer a sovereign nation, because you're always beholden to the bond market and to the price they're prepared to pay as your debt matures or you issue new debt. And the rise of China, which is surely the fastest economic rise of any nation, the only parallel might be Britain in the first decade of the Industrial Revolution, wasn't done through free markets. It was done through mercantilism and absolute state control and state subsidy and so on and so forth. So you go for a free market, depending where you are in your stage of development, depending what you want to protect or nurture. And so saying that free markets is our aim is just specious. What you might say is we want kind of fair trade where there's equity between what you sell us and what we sell you. That might be many things, but that's not free trade. That's kind of an agreement, and agreements by their nature constrain as well as allow.
What you mentioned before, Tony Abbott was a economic liberal and a social conservative. Do you think there's a problem or a difficulty that social conservatives have in trying to make their argument about social institutions and their importance within a liberal framework? Because I often find that it's very hard for them to do that, and they inevitably fail because you're saying that you believe in a system where the individual is important, that should be free from unchosen constraints in the economy, and then you're trying to make a subjective argument that this particular institution for you is important or for these particular reasons, and eventually you just lose out because freedom trumps all, and individuals should be free to do what they need to do, and your argument sort of falls on deaf ears. Do you see where I'm coming from there?
100%. But the way to sort of counter this is say, what if there are no institutions? What if it, go back to the Hobbesian paradigm. What if it was a war of all against all, and institutions were foreign to human experience? It would be what it's like being like in human history. What permanent conflict between people, no stability, no ability to prosper. And therefore, institutions are vital to maintain things like property rights or the rule of law. They only come from institutions. These things aren't in the air, they're not in the soil. They're institutions that allow something like the free market to operate. So the way I would reframe it is the free market is an institution. It's nothing else. There's nothing natural about a free market. It's an institution. And if you're in favor of free markets, you're in favor of an institution that needs permanent intervention to keep it free. And by analogy and by historical fact, freedom is not natural. Social freedom, the ability to walk down the street without being attacked, is not natural. It's only there because of the institution of social peace. And the idea, I've just been reading some books on the origin of warfare. Previously in kith and kin groups, human beings are very nice to those inside their kin. We're a bit like apes, you know? Well, we're a lot like apes. We're very nice to those within our group, and we're utterly brutal to those outside of our group. So in the earliest part of human history, we would raid other groups of human beings, kill people in dreadful ways. You excavate Neolithic settlements, and you don't find social peace. You find graves where men, women, and children had their hands tied, and they had flint daggers shoved in the back of their heads. It's horrible. And so any form of the way to deal with ahistorical and unthoughtful conservatives is just to do a bit of history. Every form of freedom that is something other than that allows you to do what you want is a social freedom permitted by others. It's just that simple. There is no individual freedom outside of your own will to do harm or do whatever you want to others. You can't own anything. You can't hold anything. You can't protect your family. You can't protect those around you. So all freedom is social. Freedom originates from constraint, not from permission. And constraint is the foundation of freedom. Freedom outside of a lone, isolated individual who isn't free at all, is preyed upon by almost everything, is not freedom at all, really.
Yeah. I mean, where this, again, the rubber hits the road is on things like marriage, right, where you've got massive breakdown in marriage in the Western world. And I think in the Anglosphere countries probably more than, well, and the Nordics more than most, right? And that surely has something to do with the emphasis that those countries place on individual freedom above.
100%. I mean, what we have to do is revise the ideation. We're all approaching, this seems continuous, the empowerment of women, which one would welcome, has gone in hand with the demographic crisis that we're now creating, so that pretty soon we'll have one third of the population supporting two thirds of the population, which is unsustainable. And having children has become so difficult, not just materially, because the evidence suggests that even having very high level material inducement to have children doesn't particularly work. It's ideational. We have to make people romantic again. We have to value children and value things we used to laugh at and sneer at, which is things like falling in love and building on that. Because unless we re-enchant our social world, we won't enter the social world. We will be completely isolated in a virtual kind of cinema, doing highly unpleasant things to images made from AI algorithms. I mean, that's the dystopia that doesn't seem so far away.
It's almost true that the notion of duty doesn't really exist. It's not poorly understood, at the very least, in Anglo-Saxon countries. You know, famously, it used to be so well understood that, you know, Lord Nelson could, you know, put up his flags and every man shall do his duty, and that's what sort of rallied the truth. But duty these days is interpreted only as a constraint or something that limits someone's freedom, right?
I think this is totally correct, but it's all going to change very soon. We are at the earliest phrases of civilizational conflict and empire conflict. I'm just writing a new book on empire and imperialism, and the idea of nationhood, which is real, has never existed outside of empire, and only empires protect nations. And we are heading into civilizational warfare, and we're not able to secure peace domestically, just as we face war internationally. So once our survival comes back into the fore, things like honor and duty will make very real sense to people. I mean, I'm often struck by how bravely Britain and Australia and Canada and New Zealand, how bravely we behaved in the Second World War. And in the 30s, there was that famous debate, where the Cambridge, Oxford colleges wouldn't okay. fight to kill their country in the 1930s. And then, of course, they all did in unprecedented numbers. So I remain, our working classes are very proud, and they are the people that beat Hitler. They are the people sort of in our history who's always defeated dictators. And we have slandered, belittled, undermined, and vilified these people. And that's been done by middle-class liberals. and there's still enough of them. What we have, though, is an enormous influx of migrants, from Muslim nations that it's imperative we integrate with. We've got to give these people a sense of being British, a sense of being Western. If you look at their fathers and grandfathers identified with Western and kind of were able to integrate quite successfully. But if you look at the indices for younger people, they've entered out the world of identity politics. They identify more, for example, as a Muslim than as a British or European citizen. That's the great threat to us, because if we can recover our shared identity and values and bind all these new Britons into a vision of Britain, for example, or Australia or France, or Germany, then we stand a chance. If we don't, then we don't.
It's interesting what you say about the importance of empire, because that differs, as you're probably well aware, with the emphasis that people that have marched under the banner of National Conservative have placed on the importance of the nation state. Maybe you can flesh that out a bit more. And where do red Tories differ from National Conservatives in your view?
I think National Conservatives, I just think it's utter nonsense. I think it's a great mistake made by good people, right? They're my friends. I like them. But nationalism can only be thought ultimately on ethnic grounds or language grounds. It's almost impossible to think nationalism on civil grounds. Obviously, there are attempts to do it, and Rome would be a very good one, but that was imperial. So nationalism, insofar as it eschews imperialism, is always going to identify who's a member of its community through racial or ethnic categorization. And for me, coming from Europe, that's when you start killing children because of who they are, that's the ultimate sign of something that's evil. And nationalism doesn't deliver on anything that it promises. It doesn't deliver for its people. It doesn't deliver for its purpose. It doesn't deliver peace. What it does is it instantiates its own internal civil war. And moreover, it makes itself powerless against more powerful neighbors. By contrast, my vision is the Christian imperial one. And by imperial, I mean the universality of the good. And that is, nations have their role, and we must defend them as distinct cultural entities and defend their borders and defend their very natures. But that is only possible through a shared universalization of the culture. And so we have to recover from this infantile idea that empires are only bad and evil. There are bad and evil empires, but there are, on the contrary, bad and evil empires are only defeated by good empires. They're never just defeated by nations. And America's an empire and Britain was an empire. And so we need to recover the notion of universality. Nationalism can't do universality. And universality is the mark of civilization. It's the mark of the Greeks. It's the mark of the Jews. It's the mark of Christians. And to some sense, it's the mark of Islam. And that I think, is integral to any civilizing project, which is what I ultimately believe in.
It isn't, okay, let me push back a little bit. I mean, isn't there something great about Italians establishing their own nation, or the Jews establishing their own nation, or a new people, Australians or Americans establishing their own nation? Can't you have a country which is formed for 90% of the people that share, you know, a similar language, a similar ethnicity, and allow a minority to gradually incorporate themselves into that at the margins while still insisting upon, you know, the dominance of a particular group without getting genocidal, and also generally share, you know, values with other nations who have a universal aspect to them. But like, you know, Joseph de Maistre, he was like, you know, conservative of the 18th, 19th century, and he was like, you know, I don't understand human rights, I understand French rights, I understand English rights, or I understand Frenchmen, I understand Englishmen. You know, I've never seen this human. I'm mangling the quote a little bit, but I get the getting the gist of it. Isn't it a conservative instinct to want to form part of a nation and preserve that?
Yes. I am not against nations, but nations only subsist and exist under the auspices of empire. And there is only an Italy, and there is only an Israel, thanks to Britain and America. If you, no nationalist autarchy can defend itself when faced with empires without also allying with empires and being protected by empires. And the only reason that there is an independent Israel, which I support, and an independent Italy, which obviously I support, is because of the Pax Americana and before it, the Pax Britannia. The nature of the state, especially the imperial state, is it marshals human force to such an extent that individual countries cannot resist it during its expansion. And it's only resisted by a countervailing force that is also imperial. And so the true nature of global governance is a contest between imperialisms. And what you have to hope is it's not Beijing that wins, but the type of Washington or a London that one might endorse or support.
What were the clash of empires involved in, say, the establishment of the Republic of Ireland or the establishment of India as an independent nation? How does that work?
Well, that works because Britain as an empire had reached it for various reasons we didn't go into now, had reached its point of maximal expansion and started to collapse back inwards. But these countries would not exist without there being an international order, whereby the violation of which would lead to greater costs for their neighbors if they intervened with them. Now, some are big enough to cause people to pause. Think of India vis-a-vis China. Think of Pakistan vis-a-vis India. The point is that ultimately the imperial logic secures the international framework within which nations can be relatively secure. If there is no international framework of costs and benefits, then you are back into the Hobbesian universe. And sovereignty then is much more fungible and much more open to erasure. There is nothing natural about borders. All borders are contested or could be contested and will be contested by a rising power. That's what history tells us. India itself is just ahistorical. Say, look, India has since 1948 has been free. It's only like 60, 70 years. Before that, India was perpetually invaded for millennia by anyone from Alexander the Great to the Mughals, to the British, to the French, to whomever. And it will be again if it doesn't place itself within a network of systems and alliances. So the security of nations depends upon things that transcend the nation. And ultimately, it depends upon an imperial power big enough to enforce costs against anyone who violates that.
So you would say Australia, we're an independent nation, but really we existed by grace of the British Empire and then now sort of thanks to the American Empire.
Yes, exactly that. Exactly that. Now you don't have a nuclear umbrella yet, tacitly you do. I've said this. I was at the Australian National, I was talking to one of your national security advisors. I can't see Britain ever allowing Australia to be really threatened. Germany is now asking Britain and France for nuclear cover versus Russia. So these aren't crazy thoughts or crazy ideas. And the rise of the imperial moment is real. And in China, that's what you're looking at. Now, at the moment, if I was in Taiwan, I wouldn't be too confident about President Trump defending me. And then if Chinese bombers hit Diego Garcia, hit kind of the nearest American bases, how stable is Australia in the face of Chinese expansion? This is kind of what more medium-term thinking has to think. So ultimately, the security of the world does depend upon there being international powers powerful enough to raise the costs of incursion. And if those international powers withdraw that cost, as Trump is doing in Europe and arguably in the Pacific as well, then we're in a different world.
Is Donald Trump a red Tory?
I think in part he is, but not in whole. I think Trump is is very complex. I think socially he's a red Tory, you know, with what he did with a series of presidential decrees on transgenderism and attacking the universities is, I think, wholly merited and vital. But I think he's a nationalist. I would view him much more in the nationalist mode of seeking to extract himself and from extensive and expensive wars abroad, as he sees it. He doesn't really see America's role. He's really retreating to a regional fortress mentality. So this stuff about taking over Canada and annexing Greenland, even suggesting the use of force to do so, isn't just mad. It sounds mad to us, but it isn't just mad. And also the Panama Canal. This is an America that's retreating and trying to secure for itself hemispheric security, if I can put it like that. So America is already in that logic, and he's not a red Tory in the fact that he can't do the universal. He can only do the particular. And that marks for me a bad empire, a nationalist empire, and something that ultimately won't succeed.
Yeah. I just sort of wondering, what about another element which I always think distinguishes what I call national conservatives from Reagan-era liberals, and that's foreign policy. I mean, a red Tory is more restrained on foreign policies, less keen to try and remake the world in a like the Americans did in Iraq and elsewhere. Is there an element of
No, I would say. Sorry to disappoint. Look, liberalism is the global hegemonic ideology. To overthrow liberalism is not to have some sort of teenage student anarchist dream where a thousand flowers bloom. It's to replace it with something else, something that isn't liberal but is more substantive. And I don't think there's any way of getting away from the universalizing project. Human civilization is universal or it's nothing. If it's particular, it's a war of all against all. And if you think the universal properly, and for me, the greatest thinking of the universal is a blend of Platonic thinking around the relationship between particulars and the universal and Christian thinking. And so I don't want, if you forgive my language, I don't want an unmediated monism where we just have one vision of the universal that is enforced everywhere. That would be like a monism without mediation. An unmediated monotheism is hell. And a lot of the Islamic fundamentalist teaching is about trying to do exactly that, where you mimic the absolute in the same way everywhere. But Greek thinking, Jewish thinking, and Christian thinking is all about how to incorporate difference and diversity within universality. And that's what I think.
So you just to be clear, on foreign policy, you would be in favor of using the strength of empire to try and enforce these universals in parts of the world.
Well, in some, you can't do everything everywhere at the same time. But I think that much of the world, look, if you abandon the world, it doesn't make you safer, right? All these people are coming across from the Middle East and from Syria and Algeria are coming because essentially global empires have given up on colonialism and given up on institutions and just left them to themselves. And they'll all end up fleeing in boats and dying on our beaches or dying in our seas because human beings are like that. They won't just roll over and die. We don't have any choice if we want to secure peace, except by trying to secure peace elsewhere. And that is inevitably an imperial mission. The United Nations, not an institution I admire or would recommend, but at least in its intention, was precisely an attempt to induce some form of structures that would prevent half the world sliding into collapse. Because if it slides into collapse, it visits us on our streets. We know that with terrorism. So we don't have an option. And a world that is the most dangerous parts of the world are uncontrolled worlds. And uncontrolled worlds always have a strongman solution. If you think of El Salvador and the kind of dictatorial governance that has been introduced to great acclaim there, that is what happens. Anarchy always resolves itself into something very authoritarian.
What about on immigration? Because it seems to me that's where the energy, political energy, has been driving reform and those party, nationalistic parties in the right in Europe, and certainly had a part to play in Donald Trump's taking the presidency. Red Tories critical of open borders.
I remember saying this to Tony Abbott, actually. I said, Tony, we're going to need to have a values-based model for migration. And the good liberal he is, he recoiled from that most vehemently. And I repeat, we are going to need to have a values-based model for migration. We simply can't import hostile minorities into our countries and think there'll be no consequence for it. That is what we've done. If you look at the case of Sweden, it's terrifying. The level of bombing, it's beyond control. They can't control their own towns and cities. And so until you have value identification and value conversion, you shouldn't have migration, because all you're going to do in this world of separated and competing ethnicities and national groups is import sectarianism. And the trouble is, our societies don't believe in anything apart from maybe sex and shopping. They don't really believe in anything at all. So it's hard to get people to believe in a new thick, if I use the term in its philosophical sense, belief of core values. And until we do, migration will always destabilize us. And what happened with Brexit, which has been a complete disaster, is we abandoned European migration of people who are essentially very like us and opened the doors to migration from countries that are very unlike us and a great social cost. So I think we've just got to be very tight on migration. Around notions of values, and unless we are, our societies won't survive it.
Yeah, I'm. When I talk to people, I always stress the fact that this project isn't really partisan. It's to try to move the bipartisan consensus in a completely different direction. I think you share that, which brings me to Blue Labor, which came not long after your book was launched. Where do you differ from those guys?
No, Morris is a good friend of mine. And I remember when he came up with Blue Labour, I was in his kitchen and I was saying, sitting with him and his kids, and I was saying, well, you know, I'm Red Tory. And he goes, I'm Blue Labour. I was there. I gave birth, at least conceptually, to that. Look, I wish them well, but I just don't think I'm different from them in the sense that I think that Morris fetishizes, and I've said this to him, so I'm not being kind of untoward, fetishizes a certain manual working class that doesn't exist. He fetishizes a 19th century model. And I don't see that it has any real consequent power. In part, Perry Anderson said this, the noted Marxist in New Left Review, that the left can't do populism, can't do post-liberalism, because it's committed to open borders. It can't think at the level of values about what we're trying to conserve. because it's committed to universals before it is to particulars. The right is committed to particulars as a way of knowing universals. So we are Burkean in that sense. We on the right proceed from knowledge of kind of what we know to love and knowledge of all. On the left, this isn't Morris's left. This is kind of the left he's fighting against. They're committed to the all before they're committed to us, the voting public. And that's why I think populism has no, in its good sense and bad sense, has no left-wing future. The left is more irredeemably liberal than the right.
Yeah,
the liberals are all on the left, I'm afraid.
But there was, you know, going back 50 or so years, there certainly was a socially conservative left in
the
UK.
Oh, God, yeah. 100%. And I like those people.
Yeah.
I, they're my friends, you know, I like them. But they have no power because the deracinated, half-educated middle class that poured out of our universities and moved into our cities are all left. So they're a small minority. What we have to do, I mean, look, people on the right call me a socialist, and people on the left, you know, call me a fascist. So there you go. You know, which is fine.
I've read some of those. It's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah, you know, you just have to be kind to ignorance, really. But the point is that we have to, left and right no longer captures what's important. Left and right is no longer the salient mode of division between human beings. It really isn't. Left and right derives from, I mean, it has its origins in the French Revolution, but it derives from a form of labor an economic organization from the 19th century. That said, class remains the main division. But how we understand class is no longer through Marxist terms. We now understand class, I think, rightly through cultural terms. So the superstructure, if I can put it like that, is more important than the base in understanding class. And that's why the right, because the right can speak to the superstructure, is the vehicle now for working class hopes and aspirations.
Last question, because I like to keep things to an hour. Paint a wildly optimistic future for the UK over the next 10 years where your Red Tory ideas are practically implemented and so many of the problems are turned around.
Okay, economically, we understand that the teachings of Chesterton and Belloc, while fanciful in direct terms, you know, a farm and a cow for each family, are right theoretically in terms of distributism. That we follow what I argued for nigh on 15, 20 years ago. We recapitalize the poor. We create asset endowments for people who have nothing. And we use those asset endowments for education or for the purchase of primary assets like homes. So we have a program of economic enfranchisement for people, allied with lifelong education and upskilling, so that the long tail of our education system doesn't abandon them when they leave school, but actually carries them through. That's the only offer. Socially, that we create the normative, we create a morality for the majority, one that protects minorities, of course, but you don't protect minorities by trying to make majorities like them, because then majorities hate minorities. You create the normative that protects the norm where most people are, morally and socially. That means protecting the family, protecting children from very extreme sexual ideologies that are nothing more than adult perversions trying to write themselves on children's minds. You also create a form of status and acknowledgement where people doing ordinary jobs are grafted with recognition of the work and glory that they do. In that sense, I would counsel everybody to read Siebold's Rings of Saturn. It's a novel, but it's a deeply Christian novel because it shows that the ordinary things show them as transcendent things. And that surely is how we must start thinking of everybody's labor and work. I think Britain, I was against Brexit. I'm one of the few people on the right that are against Brexit. I think Britain needs to recover its imperial role, recognizing that it can lead Europe, that militarily it's the strongest power in Europe, and that its culture and its values, the values of George Orwell and Disraeli, are the most redolent values and the values of Queen Elizabeth II and Prince Charles, and that these values are the most persuasive values to the world population. And try to introduce a system of institutional governance and aid that propagates those and believes those. Britain has been at the center of the world for several centuries. And looking around at the world at the moment, what seems obvious is it's not about size. It's about intellect and vision. And Britain certainly possesses enough of that for it to be a world leader again.
Well, I wish you well. I think you're certainly making a contribution to that future, hopefully, great vision. And I'm a bit more pessimistic about the UK from a distance, but that's probably because I just read the newspapers. But at the very least, from what seems a bit bleak at times, there are some great thinkers coming out of that place, and I think people in Australia would be well worth paying more attention to a lot of them. I've enjoyed chatting to you, Philip.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And I remember Australia very fondly, and Australian culture and poetry and art is a remarkable, remarkable contribution to the world. And I would just end by saying, if I may, that honestly, we have been through bleak times before. Think of William Hogarth's Gin Alley, and think of the Christian Renaissance that led the worldwide campaign against slavery. Think of those cowards in the 1930s who said they wouldn't fight for king and country. Then think of what Britain did in the Second World War. Always, always, pessimism is wrong. There are always better people with deeper values than the elites and the value systems that govern us. And we can revive them because they haven't died.
Great. If people want to find out more about you and your work, what's the best way of getting in touch? And I'll pop all this stuff in the show notes.
They can follow me on Twitter. They can email me. I'll give you all my details, and I'm happy to talk to you all. It'll be a great pleasure.
Obviously, buy your books. Thanks again, Philip, and look forward to keeping in touch in the future.
Cheers. God bless. Bye-bye.
Bye.